everyone, this is Luis Vargas, and welcome back to the Art Scene Podcast. I know it's been a while since I last posted an episode, but no worries. I'm back, and I have a whole new set of guests. So now, before I introduce my current guest and update you on some shows that are happening here, I wanted to just say that my thoughts and prayers go out to the victims of the senseless tragedy in Las Vegas this past weekend, as well as their families. And my thoughts also go out to our fellow Americans in Puerto Rico who still are struggling to recover from that disastrous hurricane. I think it's important more than ever to band together and help and support those affected by these recent tragedies in any way that we can. In the meantime, I will be sure to update you all on some events that are happening within the Bay Area community to help support these victims. Now, a couple updates in the art world. Our friends at Bassarainer Gallery currently have a new show up titled Chapel Perilous, featuring the work of David Bias, whose work in the show uses cinematic, industrial, digital motifs to place the viewer in a believable reality that they struggle to reconcile. It's a cool looking show, so be sure to see it before it closes this weekend on October 7th. And it's over at the Minnesota Street Project, so if you're in the area, go check it out. Also happening this month is former guest of the podcast, Nando Alvarez's first solo show at Interface Gallery. From October 20th to November 26th, Nando's show will present a series of new photographs along with related objects that allude to the many ways we try to make meaning of the world and predict what's to come. This week's guest is Bay Area artist Marcela Pardo Arriza, who you may have heard of before when I spoke to Mariel Bayona. Marcela's work was previously featured in the exhibition Mariel organized titled El Hábito. Currently, Marcela has a solo show up over at RSF Projects titled Slow Clap. Today, we'll hear her talk about her upbringing in Colombia, the time she spent at an international boarding school in Costa Rica, and how she got to attend a small private school in the Midwest. We'll also talk about her current art practice and her growth as a photographer. And now, here's our conversation. All right. Thank you for inviting me over to your home. I first heard of you when I interviewed Mariel.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I introduced Mariel Bayona, who actually curated the show that you were in called El Hábito over at Bassarainer Gallery.
That's right.
And that's when I first heard of you and of your work. So I was really excited. I was able to finally, one, find out how to reach you, and then two, finally be able to schedule time to meet up with you and do this podcast.
That's awesome.
And now I get to hear, I heard Mariel talk about your work, for the show, but I now get to hear about your work. And I know you just recently have a show right now, right? At RSF Projects.
Yeah. It's right up through October 8th.
And we'll talk later a little bit more about that. But, usually what I start with my guests is where you're from.
I was born in Bogota, Colombia. And I lived there until I was around 16 years old. And then I moved to Costa Rica for like 2 years. And then I moved to the U.S.
And why the move from Colombia to Costa Rica?
It's kind of like a funny story, but there's this weird international boarding school that was started the movement started after Second World War for like countries to like kind of like avoid global conflict. It's kind of very neoliberal and weird, but there's one school in Costa Rica where each country kind of sends a student from, each country sends a student to this school and you finish high school together.
Is this from like all over the world?
All over the world.
And I'm assuming it's just this kind of like, it sounds like it's like a foreign exchange program sort of, but you're actually like finishing school there.
Yeah, exactly. So we're all leaving our houses and going to live by ourselves, without parents when we were 16. And it's a bilingual program. So people go and speak English and Spanish and we take classes in both. But yeah, it's kind of crazy because you end up with roommates that my first roommates were like from Russia, Nicaragua, and like my second year was from Lebanon.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was really wild. And you see all the different kinds of living and thinking that you can possibly imagine, but I think you're still like porous enough because you're so young to like deal with conflict or like ideas differently. But my world kind of turned upside down after after moving from home.
And who runs that? Who ran that school? Like who actually created the school?
Well, this the like movement thing is called like United War College, okay. Which is it's like a double-edged sword, you know. But actually, like Nelson Mandela was kind of involved in that whole movement.
Oh wow!
There were a lot of people involved, mm-hmm. and there's around, I want to say 12, but it might be inaccurate. Colleges right now. So there's one in Wales, there's one in New Mexico.
Oh wow.
So
like same foundation or institution that runs them, but they're all in different places.
Yes. And wow. It's, you know, they have like values of like seeking and a mutual understanding between nations. Mm-hmm. But also a focus on like social justice issues and environmental issues, even though people are traveling all the time, but it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like this investment in like youth, mm-hmm. and like multicultural understanding between people from different places at a younger age.
Sure. Well, what did your parents do?
So both my parents also grew up in Colombia, and they're both theater practitioners and educators.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So when I was born, they were more involved in theater, and they were doing a lot of like, you know, I think that there's like a background of like happenings and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with a lot of very funky people around me who were like, you know, who kind of used theater in the 90s in Colombia as like this way of dealing with everything that was happening. So yeah. There was both criticality and like playfulness,
yeah.
Which definitely has influenced both my practice and both my ways of like seeing the world, you know.
Well, and what kind of theater are we talking like scripted plays, or are we you know talking about like performance art, like you know, or is it a mixture of all of it that they were doing?
I think it was a mixture of all of it. I think, you know, they were training like scripted plays because let's say I you know the educational system is still very based on like Western influences.
Oh sure, yeah.
But I think there was always a twist of like the traditional ideas that were happening, or like the locality of how this, you know, French or English or whatever plays are being reenacted in this different context, yeah. Which to me just makes it a little bit more funky and like weird.
so art was had a big place in your life growing up.
Yeah. It was kind of this like, yeah, I was like really involved in, you know, going with my parents to all these theater plays all the time, which seemed very abstract to me at the time. But I was also like going to music school since I was like very little. So I feel like they had this understanding that like art and education was this way of like dealing with what was happening at the time.
Sure. Well, what was happening at the time? Yeah, I mean, because I don't know much about in terms of the politics or the history of Colombia.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, it's a long story because yeah. It starts in the 50s, but
as every Latin American history, yeah, exactly. Right?
But you know, there's like we're talking about Bogota at the moment, but there's like this whole drug war, and at the moment I think that there was a conversation about kind of extraditing, I don't know what's the right word, kind of like making trials of drug dealers in the United States.
Sure.
So a way of protesting that extradition was, you know, putting bombs in cities or kind of hurting the civilians in a way that like put pressure on the politicians to not allow for the U.S. to like have such a big impact in what was happening internally in Colombia.
Yeah.
And besides that, there were a lot of people being displaced by the war, by like, you know, all the cultivos, I don't know how to say that, all the like
no. Well, explain it a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, no, just kind of like I feel like there was a lot of fight going about the land in Colombia, like who owned the land. People were being displaced regarding, you know, it's like so complex because I want to like,
oh yeah,
you know, you have the guerrillas, you have the paramilitary, you have the drug dealers all looking and seeking and moving resources from one place to another. You have ideologies against each other.
Right.
And the cities were being affected, not as much as like other parts of the country, for right. sure. But at that moment, I think that there was a lot of paranoia happening in the city and people trying to be like, well, we are bringing babies, we're bringing babies into this context, and we right. really don't know how to deal with the safety.
Right. It seems like there's like so many different factions and so many different interests, you know, political and mm-hmm. regional. And at the same time, it's like the people trying to like still trying to figure out how to live normal lives. But yet there's all this like stuff going on. And I guess it's still trying to like deal with it. Is that what
you're saying? Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it's also like dealing with like this generational trauma of this war that has been going on for so many decades.
Right.
And trying to gather the right understanding of what's happening is very hard, you know? Sure. I mean, it's happening right now. We don't really know. We read all these sources of news and we still don't quite understand what is happening or how to act about it.
Right. So your parents, so a lot of the work that they were doing in the theater really addressed these types of issues.
I think it was a lot of things, you know? I think they were using theater as an escape of the reality they were living. But I also think it's like not mutually exclusive, right? So even if you're doing something creative, you're incorporating all these ideas and all these fears and all this collective anxiety, you know?
Right.
So they were doing that, but they're also, both of them teach in different universities. So they were also very invested in that pedagogical movement of resistance in a different way.
Sure.
And then, you know, you have so many different elements. You have, like, both my parents were raised super religious, and they both couldn't stand it. So they also had this other element of, like, we don't have to do it this way. Let's do it a different way.
Sure.
Which is good, but I think it's a little harder to move away from that tradition when you don't have, like, this backup of, like, a lot of people doing it, right? Because it's still very rooted in, like, very traditional values.
Yeah. And do they still live in Colombia?
Yeah, they still live in Colombia.
Yeah, and they still teach and still...
Yeah, they still teach.
Still doing their thing?
Yeah.
Well, how much... Yeah. How aware were you of this going on? You know, because you didn't leave till you were 16 to Costa Rica. So up until you were 16, were you still... You know, parents were making you aware of these are the things that we're teaching and these are the things that we're trying to deal with or, you know, or teach to our students? Like, were you kind of aware of what was going on?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I feel like it's really hard. It's very hard for parents to, like, be completely transparent about all the things that were happening.
Right.
And I believe both of my parents have always been very positive or, like, very intentional about showing the positive side of things despite things that are going wrong.
Right.
And so, you know, they were teaching me certain things, but I think that the understanding came for me way later, especially after leaving home and getting some perspective. And for me, actually, what is more interesting about thinking back is what was being taught in school. Like, even though I was going to a very progressive school where we didn't even have uniforms or anything like that, which I thought was pretty cool, was that, like, we were still learning all this Western history that didn't include our own history, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like Colombian history was taught the last 2 months of... Like the last year of like high school or something. Like
you had
like, you know, like Middle Ages, Renaissance, da 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 da. And then by the time you're just like, I should know more about Colombian history at this point.
They're like, oh, by the way, so let's teach about the history you're from.
And like even like talking about, you know, Cristobal Colón, like Columbus.
Oh, right. Yeah.
There still is this like discovery story.
Right.
Which is like really fucked up.
I mean, yeah. I grew up in San Diego, and, you know, San Diego is one of the first cities that was discovered in California. Is the first city discovered, and it was part of that whole exploration period. And still, I think it's so much is left out about, like, the real history, you know, about the indigenous peoples and the treatment that, you know, and I think it's still an ongoing issue, right?
Totally.
Like, we still think it's some magical thing, like, oh, isn't it wonderful? The Spaniards came over here, discovered this land, and now we're here.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, but, you know, they killed a bunch of people to do that.
I mean, and it happens to here, you know, like, people are, like, learning about slavery, and it happened, and it's over. And you're like, no, it's definitely not over.
Yeah, that's pretty, you know, 300 years leaves a mark that will last at least another 300 years.
Yeah, it's like... Very present.
All right. So you're in Costa Rica now, and you're going to school, and you're learning all these. And I mean, for the most part, you've been learning a varied amount of subjects, you know, at the school. Were at that point you were like, I really like art and this is something I want to pursue, or you were still kind of trying to figure out during those years what exactly you wanted to study afterwards?
Yeah. Well, I always wanted to be a musician, which was like, you know, because I was trained as one. But then when I went to Costa Rica, I feel like I got more into art, history and art, but also into sociology, because that's I've been like always very obsessed with theory and how to like materialize that theory in one way or another. In a more creative way.
What instrument did you play?
I play the violin.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm assuming through childhood and then...
Yeah.
And then you just... when you got to Costa Rica, you're like, eh.
No, I mean, I kept playing. And in college, I would like do like orchestra stuff, which I enjoy way more playing with other people than like the whole, you know? But like classical music is so like uptight. And so I like got into jazz and I was like, this is a little looser. Yeah, like it's just like not my vibe, you know.
Do you still play now or?
Yeah, I play sometimes, but definitely not as like rigorously as
so you
like,
have a violin with
I have a violin with me.
Oh, that's cool.
And a banjo too, but that's just another story.
All right, so you're into sociology, you're into art, and when you get done with the school, what is your next step? Like
So then the thing about the schools is that, you know, a lot of the U.S. colleges look at the schools as this very promising places in which to recruit like diverse students.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, these people already left home. So they already went crazy. These people, you know, like already left their parents. So they're like self-sufficient in one way or another. And they speak English and they have studied in English. So we know that they can perform a certain way. So they have all this funding for this kind of students. And then so a lot of schools actually come and like pitch in,
That's
you
so
know,
funny.
Do their pitch, which is really funny and like very weird because, it's just it's kind of, you know, fucked up in one way or another because there are all these kids that like if there was not the option to go to the U.S., to the U.S., they would go back to their countries and maybe do some other work there.
Right. They're not going to like an actual like high school in Colombia to recruit students. They're going to a school that's already they've already handpicked like students that were already specifically educated a certain way. It sounds like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in a very standardized way that like kind of fits the educational
system here. Easy transition.
Here.
Yeah. An easy transition to the university system here.
So I wasn't really sure what was going on because I just applied to schools. Everyone was applying. You know, you don't really know what's happening. You're like, oh, there's some scholarships. I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
and that's and I'm assuming you're applying. Are you just applying to American schools?
Yeah.
And I assume being like, you know, you're from Colombia and living in Costa Rica. How do you even know what schools to even think about going to, you know?
Yeah. I didn't know. And like people were, it was really funny because people are talking about which schools. And I was like, well, I don't know, but Harvard and all of those things sound very pretentious to me. And,
and
so
are.
I was like, I don't even want to like, you know, because even though those were the names that like, you know, the most, but I was just like, I don't even see myself like that seems so far removed from my reality.
Yeah.
So then I applied to a bunch of schools. But like there was one I ended up going to this school, which is like completely crazy story. Where I ended up going to this school in Indiana, in the Midwest.
Right.
So, and I had never been in the United States before, so I arrived to the Midwest, and I was
you found out what Indiana was?
Yeah. And I was like, what? This is what people talk about the U.S.? Like, people are so conservative. And so it was really weird and quite shocking to go from this place where there are people from all over to, like, this very white, traditional kind of setting, you know?
What's the university you went to?
It's called Earlham College.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And it's
It's a private school, right?
It's a private school, and it's like a liberal arts school.
Sure.
And it's Quaker, which I didn't know what it was before going.
Yeah.
Which is also funny.
What made you choose that school?
I feel like at the moment there was like a friend of mine that had gone there, and he really liked it. And the consular at, like, Costa Rica said, like, there's a lot of weird kids that go there. And, like, and I was like, oh, that sounds intriguing. and then I, like, read the Wikipedia article that said that there was a lot of jazz recordings made in that town. And I was like, okay, that sounds cool.
Wow.
Let's go.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was interesting because at the end of it all, like, it was... you know, free for me to go to school in in the US, and it would have been so much more expensive to go to university back home, even though back home is way cheaper.
I know. Isn't that
comparatively,
funny?
Yeah.
What a weird situation you're put in, right?
Yeah, yes. So that was weird, but it's interesting because there's a lot of people from cities that ended up in this school that were a little bit more progressive, or in kind of, instead of being like the highlight of this, you know, instead of like reaching for the spotlight, were interested in like changing the country from within. So kind of like going to these like towns.
Right.
To make the change there, which to me is also very interesting because we tend to go to places like New York, LA, San Francisco, Chicago.
Which are already progressive in their own way. Yeah.
I mean, not completely, but yes.
But compared to a small town in Indiana, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
But then what was interesting about going to school in Indiana was like, obviously there's so much space, and like it felt to me like there were abundant resources. Like I had never seen anything like that, just like in terms of size, like the classrooms, all these things that you're just like, I've never seen this kind of like educational investment. And also, you know, so much food and like all these things. But what was interesting was finding like the smaller communities that were able to survive within that very hostile, quote unquote, environment of Indiana, right? So like seeing like a queer community or like an undocumented immigrant community. And how they were like essentially trying to live their own way within these places. It's like a very harsh comparison between the two, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting because you, I mean, I guess the question is, would you consider yourself an immigrant now? Because you came in through a different way than most immigrants do, right?
Yeah, totally.
Because you came in through the way of education, and you were provided these opportunities through education.
For
like,
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's like, yeah, I feel like so many people come here through some educational system too.
Right. And not only did you come here through education, they are recruiting you to come. Like the American professors and schools are coming to you saying, we want you to come over here. Will you come over here, please?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's... Yes, so intense in a different way, you know.
Well, and so overall, you liked your experience there.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm a very adaptable person.
Okay.
But yeah, I felt like there were a lot of professors that were like extremely critical of how things were working.
Yeah.
And had a lot of time to invest in the students, so there was a lot of mentorship that I was like very honored to have. And like also in arts, you know, I had a darkroom for myself, basically, that was like 24 hours, basically 100 meters from my dorm, which seems crazy to me right now, you know?
Yeah.
So then I
was going to ask you a little later on, but we'll get to it right now. I mean, so it's during this time you decide you want to be a visual artist. What made you choose photography as the medium? Or did you try a couple before you settled on photography?
I started painting before. That was kind of like my thing. And then I signed up for a painting class on the teacher. And I was like, hey, can you like teach us more technical stuff? Like, I really want to know how to like mix color and stuff.
Yeah.
He was like, no, we, you know, it's like contemporary painting. Like, I can't teach you technique. Like, it's all about like conceptual, whatever. And I was like, oh, this guy's full of shit.
Yeah.
So then I was like, wait, I can do that by myself. Like, I don't need to like take a class to be like, to just do what I want to do. So I started taking photography, and I feel like there was like a click, like an undeniable click that like felt so strong to me, you know? And then there's that cliche magic of like being in the dark room in this meditative space.
Oh yeah. I studied photography in undergrad too. And, I loved it.
Yeah. It's just so magical how you can materialize an idea like in such a,
And I went to a private school too in San Diego. It was a small private school, but we had a dark room like that where, you know, it was literally like 5 minutes from my dorm room, and I could get the key whenever I wanted, and I could be there till 2 a.m. by myself. And it was the most amazing thing to just, like you said, meditative. It really is. If I needed to just get away, I could just do that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And people, I think that's the, it sucks because our dark rooms are dying, right?
Yeah. Like,
but I love that. I think that's the one thing I miss about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, it has such a power that I don't think, you know, anything else has.
For sure.
And the reason why it's dying is also because it takes time. Mm-hmm. and we don't have time, or we're made to believe that we don't have time. But I like that about it, that there's so many steps, you know, that something in digital photography would be so much faster.
Sure. What kind of work are you making, right? Like, are you, what kind of photographs are you producing
at in that moment?
Yeah.
Well, you know, as I was taking that, my first, like, photo class, there was also, like, a history of art class, and also this, like, I mean, this post-colonial theory class that, like, really blew my mind, and that's how, kind of, how I started becoming so aware of all these ideas that, like, you know, in Colombia, you have a language for it, and then here, like, you become very aware of, like, your identity immediately. It's like people just read you in a way. And at first, you're like, why are people talking like this? Everything's about race in such a, like, upfront way. Mm-hmm. And so that really helped me understand kind of this whole cultural shock of the States. But, I mean, at the moment, I wanted to move away from very cliche, like, you know, photo one assignment, like, results of the things while also learning it. But I also, you know, it's, you see the examples of what you can produce. And I was just like, I don't want to make, like, the same exercise that everyone's doing in that time. So one of the first things that I did was photographing exes, you know, two people that used to be together, and kind of make them have, like, a close, intimate relationship again.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
So a friend of mine agreed to do it with his ex-partner, and so I, like, kind of photographed them together and seeing how their bodies remembered each other, even though they were no longer, like, in this committed relationship. So that was kind of one of the first projects that I did in which I, like, realized the power of, like, photography, that I could enter this, like, seemingly intimate space between these two people, but also create an environment that wouldn't have existed otherwise, right? Like, I don't know that they would have remet again naked to reenact having an intimate relationship.
Yeah.
So in that way, I started realizing kind of that power of, like, entering the spaces and directing something.
Right. And is that the one of the first series that's on you, that I saw on your website? Is that first where there's a, it's like a couple, right? And they're not fully clothed for the most part. Like, you know, yeah, that work is interesting because you still add some color to it. Like, there's
I know which one you're talking about. It's not that
it's
one.
It's not that.
But no, but it's similar. This one is still black and white.
So you start out black and white.
Yeah.
And what made you, when did you start going to color? Was it still in school? Like, you switched over, or are you still working on black and white throughout this entire time?
I started working in color when I moved to California.
Really? Yeah. So you really stuck with black and white that whole time?
Yeah.
And what was it about, why is that? What was it about black and white photography that you liked doing that work in?
Well, I mean, at the time was that, like, you could process the film in the darkroom,
right,
too. So it was part of the process. And I still was very, you know, kind of introduced to the medium of photography. And at the time, I felt very, like, oh, digital can look so, like, weird and, like, so over the top. It still had an aesthetic.
This is really,
you know,
shocking, because, I mean, you seeing your work now is so beautiful, it's so colorful. So, like, to hear you say that that's what you were thinking of at that time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, I think back at it, and it's kind of crazy, but it's also like this. It's like a new aesthetic that you're getting used to.
Sure.
And it's also like the aesthetic needs to, like, lure you in before you can, like, make it the thing that you want.
Yeah.
So the more I learn about photography, the more I started getting into digital. But also, I think it was also very chronological, you know? Like, you start learning about photography from the beginning, so you're kind of having this parallel realization of, like, your practice and what you're learning.
Yeah. And it's not a medium that you were really, you knew a lot about before you went to college, right? So you're learning it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're learning it as you go.
Yeah.
All right, so then when you got to the end of your 4 years of undergrad, were you determined at that point, like, I got to keep going, I got to go to grad school, and I, like, did you, were you at that point determined that, you know, to be a visual artist for a living, or for, you know, for a career or some sort?
Yeah, so, you know, there was this kind of exchange program when I was a junior, where you could go to New York for a semester, and it's called, like, the New York Arts Program.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was interesting because there's all these different exchange programs in these universities, you know, like Tanzania, all these countries. But the idea of going to one of these trips with, like, you know, 15 Americans, I was like, I don't know that I can do it.
Why? Why do you say that?
Because, you know, I mean, not to be, like, hateful at all. No. I feel it's very hard sometimes to travel in those settings, you know, right. those educational settings where they're like, we're going to go to Tanzania and learn, like, what the animals do. And you're like, oh.
Yeah, like, it's too touristy for you.
It's, like, touristy, feels very colonial. Mm. People are like, oh, my God, let's get wasted.
Yeah.
And then you go to these places and, like, you know, people...
Because you've already heard about how people get when they study abroad then at this point. It's just a party.
It's a party. Like, yeah. It feels like consuming this culture. Sure. And, like,
you're 100% right. Yeah. I never studied abroad when I was undergrad, but I had friends that did, and all I heard was just like, so basically you just drank for 4 months. Like,
exactly. Like, and so, like, that to me, just that idea after the whole Costa Rica thing, I was just like, it just feels so disrespectful. It feels so, like, unthoughtful. I don't feel like the institutions give the tools for people to understand that they're, like, actually in a place that is not their own.
Right.
And, like, how are you respectful? How do you communicate differently? How do you try to learn the language? You know, sure. Like, some people would just go, they don't speak the language, and then
right.
they would expect people to speak English all the time. And I'm not saying this is the whole,
no, that everyone, not everyone does that, but, you know? But at least in your particular situation, this is what you were hearing about it.
Yeah.
And so that turned you off a little bit.
Yeah, the perspective. I was like, oh, I don't
yeah.
know. But this New York Arts program was like, I was like, oh, it's here. So, like, and I get to see other part of the United States.
Right. I mean, you're technically already in another country, right?
Yeah. So, and this was cool because they have these, like, residences or dormitories or whatever in, like, the middle of Chelsea, which is crazy.
That's
right.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So me and my friend went and we were living there for 6 months. And the program is cool because it has a lot of elements. Like, you intern with two... entities. So I was interning with the International Center of Photography in their education department, which was really awesome because it, like, gave me access to all this archive, all these teachers. And then my mentor signed me up to, like, a color darkroom class and a digital class.
You did a color darkroom?
So I did a color
darkroom. With all the chemicals and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I never got to do that because they kept telling us it was so dangerous.
Yeah, like, I mean, it still was with the printer
right.
thing. Like, you had to pass it in. But, I mean, I had never seen that before.
Yeah.
And then the other person that I interned with was Sebastian Bremer, mm-hmm. who is, like, this Dutch artist that, like, paints on top of the photographs. And then they have this other thing where you go on studio visits with your mentor. So, like, the whole group would go to all these studio visits. And so you get to see all these artists who were, like, I mean, I can't remember off the top of my head, like, a name.
Sure.
But you get to see them in their studios. You move around the city. You're doing things. So I was, like, mind blown. And it was kind of like this permission to enter this new world, you know? Like, my mentor being like, you know, all these galleries, they look pretentious, but, like, you can enter anytime and it's right. free. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Nobody has ever said that. And we were living in Chelsea, so we were going to all the openings, like, every Thursday, just going through the...
Yeah. So you felt like, in this type of trip, you were able to really immerse yourself in that, not only in the culture of the city, but, like, you were really able to get a real-life experience of, like, the art scene.
Yeah. And also, like, we were really broke, so we were, like, living on nothing in New York, trying sure. to meet people and being weird. So, yeah, it was, like, this experience of seeing, like, okay, we can live like artists. You can live with very little if you know how to do it. Yeah, so I was like, oh, I feel like I want to move here after I finish.
And did you?
Yes.
So you graduated. Did you go straight to New York City?
Yes. Yeah, I moved all my things. I was driving with my partner at the time. My parents, we all drove to my new apartment in New York City. That was actually kind of like a shithole.
That old trip.
But that's just part of it. Yeah, I was living with other people from college. We all moved to Brooklyn.
And did you have, like, a job lined up? You're just like, let's just do it. Let's just do this.
Yeah,
adventure.
I was just like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
Let's do it. And it was weird, right? Because at that time, I had, like, the student visa that you could have for, like, an extra year after college.
Right, yeah. They give you a year, basically. Yeah. Stay, figure out, and find a job, basically. Yeah,
exactly. So I technically had to have an internship of some kind mm-hmm. to, like, kind of keep the status.
Sure.
So I was like looking for things, but like nothing was responding. You know, no one was getting back to me. And I was like, oh, what's happened? Like, why? You know, I was like learning all these things of like applying to a job in the States.
Sure.
All these rules that and protocols that nobody really teaches you. So and then I was kind of running out of money, but I found this queer little coffee shop bar that hired me and under the table, which was amazing because it became like a family and kind of like, you know, just a place to like be able to exist in New York. And at the same time, I started interning for Clock Tower Gallery, which is one of the oldest like alternative art spaces. And it was started by Alana Hess, who started PS1. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of like her side project that then became her main project. And then I eventually started working like as an employee with them, you know.
What kind of stuff were you doing for them?
At first I was, you know, I was like doing installation work and like just helping with random things. And then I started working with more closely with Joe Ahern, who's kind of this amazing DIY culture producer in New York. As kind of, we were doing like performance festivals. They had like residence artists in this Clock Tower, which was this like, I don't know, this huge space in the top of a building that was kind of like, you had to, you know, you had to leave all your things. There was security, and then you would come to this kind of utopian artist place where there were like studios for artists in residence. So I would be working with them as well.
How long were you in New York this whole time? That whole time?
Like 2.5 years. That long? 2 years?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I wasn't there.
Yeah, I feel like I was, but I forgot already.
So what did you get out of that experience, you think? Was it just more, it sounds like it was more of an extension of your education in photography.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like what I gained from that experience was the seeing all the range of possibilities that both art gave you, how community would look like, what kind of, you know, commercial galleries versus alternative art spaces.
Sure.
The use of space in such a, like, you know, heavily wanted city. The creation of unique experiences that are, like, affordable. Mm-hmm. There were, like, so many different things that were happening. And then seeing people so overly invested in creating experiences for other people in so many different layers,
yeah.
So many very, very like playful and weird ways,
yeah.
Which to me was like very inspiring, you know, to see how despite the cost of living being so high, despite housing being really hard to find,
sure.
People are still making time and creating things to communicate with other people through like, you know, concerts, art exhibitions, like weird rooftop things, weird things.
Right.
So, yeah, it was, you know, blew my mind.
Sure. I mean, it's what you think of when you want to be in that art community. Like, what it's the parts that make you love it, right? Like, mm-hmm. You got to really be in it. You got to really experience all that firsthand.
Yeah. And it just, like, seeing, I feel like the most, like, amazing thing was realizing that the stereotype of the artist as, like, a lazy person.
Right.
Was completely, like, bullshit.
For sure.
Because these people were so committed and so disciplined and like barely had time to themselves.
Oh yeah.
And that was like very inspirational also because I've always been very like ambitious and like restless.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, this is where people like me exist.
Yeah. Like it's not. Yeah. And it's, you know, I remember learning about that. I think I got that first hint of it when I was an undergrad because somebody, my senior year, like I had a major, I was a history major. And I double majored in photography. But I remember I had, by my senior year, the only classes I had was photography and art, like just art making classes.
That's awesome.
Because I had finished my major like ahead of time by my junior year. And that was the hardest working year of my entire 4 years. Like I wrote 10-page papers for like history courses and stuff and like, but that year was the hard, and mainly because just people don't understand how much time it takes, one, to be in a dark room, and over again, you're like trying to get the right picture. Mm-hmm. You're spending hours like researching like how you're going to do something a certain way. And you're literally working with your hands and you're like working and moving and building stuff. And like, I think people underestimate that, like mm-hmm. about art, about being an artist or working in the art world is that it is a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a hustle. It's a big hustle.
But it, yeah, and especially, you know, by the end of like college, I was taking pictures of groups of people that were like interacting with each other. So, which had kind of like the production aspect of like trying to gather these people and like the scheduling, whatever, and like getting all these people that don't know each other into a room so we could do this kind of performance.
For, sure. You know? Yeah.
But yeah, I feel that it takes so long to like.
Yeah, the setup for something like that takes a couple hours before you actually just snap the picture.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not into, you know, like snapping the picture. Yeah, of course, so much thought goes into it, but like by the time you're taking the picture, like this shot is already.
Right, it's already been made.
Yeah,
all you're doing is pressing a button at that point.
Yeah, I mean, you're deciding, obviously, you know, things change and whatnot. You're playing with the energy of the room. But that's not what interests me the most, you know.
It was the work. It was the work.
The building up to this.
The preparation for it.
To that moment in time.
Yeah. And so at this point, you know, what made you want to move out to San Francisco for grad school?
So, you know, I was like, thinking that like my visa was gonna run out, so I was like, oh, the best way to like keep being in the US is applying to grad school. So I applied to a bunch of grad schools and I was visiting stuff, you know, like Pratt and like Hunter College, because people talked about Hunter, which is like affordable and has, you know, prestigious in its own ways. I still didn't want to apply to the pretentious schools. And then so then I feel like, you know, I got into some of them and then I ended up deciding between Hunter and SFAI because what happened? Oh, between all of those, between visiting schools, I found, you know, I was like reading about San Francisco Art Institute and I was like, oh, well, yeah, they don't have to be in New York, I guess. I guess it would be kind of hard to go to grad school in New York because it's so wild, you know? Like, I was like, maybe I should consider another place. So I saw.
Wait, so were you like worried that like if I went to grad school in New York City that you were just gonna party too much?
Well, it's just so hard because you have this constant feeling of like so much going on.
Sure.
That you can actually have like that calm moment to like wonder about like a personal project.
Sure.
Like it's actually very hard to find that space.
Is that something you learn to appreciate when you're in Indiana? Because there's like. I mean, let's be real, it's nothing to do probably, right? Compared to New York City.
Compared to New York City,
yeah. So I would assume you had a lot of time to be able to contemplate on your own.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, space for wonder, especially when you're in an educational space, can be very productive.
Right.
You know? So I didn't want to kill that potential necessarily. So I came to California, actually, to visit the schools.
What are the schools you're looking at here?
CCA and SFAI.
Okay.
And I mean, it was great because I saw SFAI's campus and I was like, this feels so magical. This,
sure.
You know, like in my imaginary of like what an art school looks like, I was like, I can see myself here. Like,
beautiful Diego Gallery, the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it just has like aesthetic to it and like the city is so.
Yeah, it's different.
Picturesque.
It's like, yeah, it's perfect.
And then CCA too. You know, I thought CCA was great too. So, and I was like, the weather here is kind of similar to home. And I was like, oh, this seems good. But, I mean, I couldn't really afford here to come to any of these schools otherwise, you know. Like, everything was so expensive. So, the decision came to Hunter or SFAI. And, like, Hunter had, like, this amazing studios, you know, looking at the city. Something crazy and, you know. But then I was like, well, SFAI seems kind of like a better ideological place. And in San Francisco, like all the queer things going on. And I was living with my partner at the time. And we were like trying to decide what was better, whether we wanted to move or whether we wanted to stay in New York.
Yeah.
You know?
So you really like at this point, too, you're also considering you're with a partner. So you're also considering what's a place for them to feel comfortable in as well, totally. Right? Because they're coming with you.
Yeah.
Right,
I mean, and also, like, they had their thing going on here, you know. But I think what we both gravitated towards was, like, that sense of, like, let's just do something new. Let's just adventure. So we took our station wagon, our Volvo, and, like, drove across the country with all our things.
Yeah.
And we're just like, let's just go there.
Yeah.
And it was funny because we had like a Skype interview before to like, you know, everyone was telling us that the housing market was so crazy.
Oh, yeah.
But we just wrote to one person and we had a Skype interview and they were like, okay, you have a place. And I was like, okay, that was easy. So we just drove across the country and like,
isn't that crazy how that works? Like, I mean, I was the same way, like, you know, with my fiance, like she came up with me too. Like, it was a decision like that too, where we had to really think about, listen, I'm stuck between this school and, you know, would you come with me? And she was like, yeah, of course, you know. But I remember that everyone kept telling us, oh, how hard it was.
Yeah.
We found an apartment in like the one and only weekend she was able to come up and like look for apartments. And like in one day we like found it. And it was like, oh, that was easy.
It's yeah, I mean, I don't know. The energies of places are so insane sometimes because it's obviously not easy for everyone. And we just got very lucky, right?
You're right, yeah.
And it was good because it was this like, it felt like this house that had been queer for like many years.
Sure.
And there was like this Venezuelan guy living there too. So I was like, okay, let's just do it. So if, and then I really wanted to live in the Mission District because it felt like this very hybrid place.
Sure.
Of like, you know, Spanish speaking, Latino community.
Right.
And
you still want something a little bit more like, I mean, for me, for instance, like I live out in the outer Richmond District and every once in a while I have to come out here. Because it reminds me of living in San Diego, where there's a lot of Mexican people and like other Hispanics living and speaking Spanish. And
yeah, it just felt more familiar. Yeah. I mean, familiar and like real and still very critical in in that I didn't know it so well then, you know.
Right.
I just had this idea of like, oh, finally, I do want to live in a Latino neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like, I've been craving this for so long, you know. Yeah. I've left home for so many years.
And so then, all right, so now you're in grad school.
I'm glad we made it to
We made it to grad school. We made it to SFI. You're now in San Francisco. Which, by the way, this is a very interesting like life journey you've had to get to San Francisco. But you're here now and you're getting your MFA.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you stuck with photography.
Mm-hmm.
When does all the color come to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole idea of San Francisco was that it had such a big legacy of photography as a medium and of queerness too, right?
Sure.
So then my first project, I wanted to have kind of like heighten those kind of two things. So I did this series called David, David, David that you were talking about, where these two individuals that are somewhat androgynous share different settings in a domestic space and they don't interact with each other, but one of them is constantly looking at the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one's a little bit more submissive, and you wonder whether or not they're like lovers or relatives or friends. But the cool thing was that this domestic space was ended up being a house in Oakland that was really weirdly decorated, and that I had seen once, and I thought my really good friend Juan Pablo that I went to SFI with, he used to live there, and I saw that house. I said, we need to do something here.
Yeah.
And so it felt also like the first project that I did in grad school. So Juan Pablo was there because he lived there. And he also went to Costa Rica, but that's a different, we go way back.
Yeah.
And then Simon too, who is also an MFA graduate. So it was kind of this opportunity for like a group dynamic thing and the exploration of, you know, black and white can be so forgiving, right? Because you just have this range tonality.
Sure.
So even if you have objects that don't, you know, even if you have random objects, like the photo still forgives it.
Sure.
Because they don't call your attention as much. So I like that color was a little bit like less forgiving in that way. That
yeah.
you had to be like, you know, if this element doesn't go with the thing, it's gonna pop out.
Right.
Pop out, right? And it also had that cinematic look that I was like really into.
Mm-hmm.
And then California, I feel like California definitely had this like influence into like using color again.
Yeah.
Like suddenly black and white feels so outdated.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, tell me, what's your impressions of California? I'm interested because I'm a Californian, I'm not even a Northern Californian. I'm a Southern Californian, which is a little different from up here. So I'm interested. What was that feeling you were getting that like felt like you needed to like for your photographs to pop out more?
More than like the photographs to pop out more, I think that it was like a different language.
Mm.
You know that like I felt like the reading of a black and white photograph from afar has already all the signifiers within it, right? It feels like time or timeless sometimes. It feels like you're like limited, like you're limited by the size if you're doing darkroom stuff. And so it was like this liberation moment where I was like, well, I have all the resources to like print really large scale. I have this all these cameras that I had never had the chance to play with, you know, like digital cameras. I didn't really have them before.
Yeah.
I came to SFAI. So it was this idea to like play with all these tools and kind of be like, I'm just going to do something new.
Yeah. Like you were like able to just come out of this like you felt like you were in a box and you're only working in this box and you like just kind of came out of it. Yeah, a little totally. Bit. Yeah.
And also because, you know, in Indiana we had darkroom photography. We didn't really have digital photography.
They didn't even have computers to go on Photoshop and stuff.
Not that I remember. Like there just wasn't a digital photography class.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So it was like this like very out of reach kind of thing.
Yeah. You had a traditional education in terms of that when you were first starting out in photography.
For sure. For sure. Like everything was very DIY.
And SFAI, of course, is not. I mean, some parts of it can be traditional, but like for the most part, they really emphasize like conceptual art and they really make you think.
Mm-hmm.
Outside the box.
I mean, one of the reasons why I also wanted to come to SFAI is because they had critical theory classes.
Yeah.
That were part of the curriculum.
Sure.
And that to me was like fundamental because I've always had like this other side of me that like loves to read things and like problematize what is happening currently. And I was like, yes, like artists need to like be a little bit more aware.
Yeah.
Even if their work doesn't like show it. To at least have that curiosity of like criticality, you know?
Sure. Well, and you know, looking at your work, one of the two things that pop out, you know, because now building off of what you just said, is one, obviously the color, which I've mentioned. I mean, that's the number one thing that pops out to me is the saturation, the brightness. I think the way you match the color with the subjects, even in the photographs that you make. Sometimes I don't even know if they are photographs because it's just so. I don't know how they're made. Like, I mean, which is great. For me, that's the sign of great artwork for me is like half the time, like if I don't know how they even did this, it's I love that. And the other thing is, you know, you were talking about feeling like you were able to come out of stuff is the, you know, I've seen some of your work when you had your work shown at Bastien Rayner.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like your work is not just contained in the frame itself, but it's like, it's like bleeding onto whatever it touches, whether it's on the wall or the floor. And I see that in the current show, even like over at RSF Projects. So tell me a little bit about that, because for me, you're taking this two-dimensional, you know, traditionally photographs are shown two-dimensionally, but you're taking it outside of that realm and you're really making it almost sculptural, almost like installation-like.
I mean, you know, photography is so dogmatic sometimes.
I know.
And which can make it so boring, you know? There's like all these technicalities and people are like, which camera do you use? What do you do this? Which is fine, like people are really into that.
Sure.
And then with presentation, there's all these other sets of practicalities and like traditional ways of like presenting the work, but also of keeping the work the most archival it can be. But photography is really like an archival.
Sure.
Like nothing is really permanent to begin with, and we should just give up on that idea.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, like the archival factor is so fundamental to the shape that the work takes, right?
Yeah.
Which still haunts me for sure, and I'm still dealing with those ideas. But what attracted me from the medium itself is how you make a two-dimensional object from the world, which is three-dimensional, right?
Right.
And that, like, flattening of space is the most romantic thing about photography. So the flattening of space happens, and then you put it in this frame. But the idea of coming out of that frame makes the photograph become three-dimensional again.
Yeah.
So, like, this kind of, like, you know, you go from reality, you make a set, you make the props, whatever. You put it into a photograph that's two-dimensional, and by adding all these other elements to it, you're kind of bringing that photograph back to its three-dimensionality.
Right.
And the other thing is that photography is really new, and I don't understand why, like, if it's so new, we're still so, like, there's so many rules to it.
Right. Why are we still thinking like the past?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is, you know, I don't think it's an insular thing that is happening. I think a lot of photographers are trying to expand on like what the shape of photography is.
Yeah.
or can be, or like what's the potential that it truly has.
Yeah.
And there's also the whole debate about what's the role of photography in the digital age, yeah. right? Like, how do we experience images in this, you know, infinite scroll of images? And I think the idea of coming back to a unique object that's three-dimensional kind of makes the viewer have to see it for themselves
sure.
in one way or another. But it also makes the work take this physicality that can really be represented in the digital world.
Right.
So, I don't know. I feel like it's about games, too, and, like, tricking the audience,
yeah.
Inviting them in different ways, kind of luring them in.
Yeah, it does look like you have fun with it, too, a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If it's fun,
yeah, because, I mean, you have, you know, if you have a yellow photograph, you have, like, a streak of yellow painted on the wall leading to the floor, and sometimes even having it continue onto the floor. It's great. I mean, it's one of those things where you're right. I mentioned I study photography, and, mm-hmm. and one of the things that I've always been interested in, and I, you know, and working in museums, and what I was always interested in studying in was new ways to exhibit photography or new ways to show work. And I don't think curators, they're so traditional. Like, it has to be hung this way and neatly yeah. placed on the wall. But the artists who are making the work are actually. Yeah. For me, doing a better job of figuring out creative ways of exhibiting their own work.
Well, and it's interesting. You know, I would problematize that a little bit because some artists are very traditional.
Sure.
And some curators are very non-traditional too.
Yeah.
Which is cool too.
I guess what I'm saying is, in my experience, I don't see a lot of photographic curators doing the type of stuff that you do with your work.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say never, you know, like, I'm sure someone out there is doing some
sure, somebody, cool thing. But not a
trying
lot.
Trying to push it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, with the artists, it depends. It depends, you know. I think a curator wouldn't be, like, tacitly against
sure.
Placing photography differently. But there are very, these dogmatic rules that we're talking about
sure.
of the museum, right? So, like, you hang it at a certain height, or, you know, there's certain space between them. Also, photography sometimes is very, like, you know, you take the book of photographs and you have, like, a case study that is very formulaic. So
yeah.
you're turning the pages and you know that it's the same thing, but slightly different.
Sure.
Which I like some of those books, too.
Yeah.
But sometimes I find that a little limiting. And so you can see my work. I don't work with, like, more than 7 or 8 pictures at a time.
Right.
Because my yeah. series tend to be a little bit more concise in number because they expand in different ways.
Yeah.
They're not quantitative.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, but before I finish off, I wanted one to ask, you know, and I asked this of all my guests, like, mm-hmm. where do you see yourself, 5-10 years? Do you still see yourself making a living off of your work or do you see yourself doing a multitude of things, you know, like teaching, working, making art? Like, what do you see yourself doing?
That's a very good question.
And it's okay if you don't have an answer.
No, I feel like there's so many things in my head. Like, a part of me wants to keep making work and organizing exhibitions, but also, like, learning more about what the role of the artist can be in our society, in our current society where everything is going on, what we can actually do to, like, fight oppression. It's so real. I feel like there's, like, you know, this urgency that I feel like every day that actually becomes makes me doubt a lot of the artistic practice and how we think about artistic practice
mm-hmm.
nowadays. So I'm interested to see how that might change. But there's something about making work that is kind of like such a necessity to me as
yeah.
well. So that would kind of become like this parallel thing. But I'm just very interested in gaining more skillful, like, different sets of skills, you
yeah.
know, like a wild me wants to be like a carpenter and build like crazy structures, you know?
Yeah.
But also just, like, welding and, like, just keep taking classes and, like, teaching and keep kind of networking with different types of people and seeing how we can, like, create different things together.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, this is great. Thanks and for I feel me. Like I could talk to you for like a whole nother hour.
I know, me too. It's very nice to meet you.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? I may have you back on, you know.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. I love having people back on and continuing more stuff and building on stuff that they've mentioned in previous conversations with me. But before we go, I wanted to give you opportunity again to plug your show and till how long it's going to go and where we can go see it.
Awesome. So the show is called Slow Clap, in SEPA and RSF Projects through October 8th.
Okay.
And I'm actually going to have a soft closing on the 8th from 6 to 8.
Great.
So come on over.
Yeah.
Yeah, all let's right. have some fun.
Well, thanks.
All right, that's it for today. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Marcella for coming onto the podcast. Her show titled Slow Clap will be up until October 8th this weekend, and there will be a closing reception that evening as well. For more information on the show, visit rsfprojects.com, and to learn more about Marcella and her work, visit her website at marcellapardo.com or follow her on Instagram at marcellopardoa. And also be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a review if you can. It helps spread the word about the show. Till next time.